My name is Roger Field. I'm working with the American Lutheran Church as the liaison person between the American Lutheran Church and the Commission for a New Lutheran Church. And this week, developing a series of discussions or tapes on the issues in the formation of the new church. Today is session 4 of that, and its title is The Search for Servant Structures. Let's begin in prayer. Heavenly Father, committed and dedicated women and men of our churches are working to design a church which will be more responsive to your world and more effective in witnessing to your gospel in both word and deed. Bless those women and men. Give them wisdom and insight, a creative understanding of both the gospel and the church. Help us through this process to become a stronger and a more serving church, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Today we tackle the question of polity, and I'll try to define the word so that I can then use it the rest of the hour. Polity is how an organization, in this case a church, decides to organize itself, to govern itself, and to enable its ministries. And the fact that there are any number of polities available, and at least 5 major kinds of polities that have been practiced in the history of the church, suggests that polity is always a choice among options, not something that simply jumps right out at us from Scripture and becomes the way to do it. So we're looking at a huge question. I don't pretend to be able to cover it in an hour, but maybe to shed some perspective so that as you read the things that come out of the Commission for New Lutheran Church in the next 4 years, you will have some of this framework as one of the points of reference. At stake, just to give you an idea of the scale of this thing, at stake in the decisions about how the new church is going to organize and govern and do ministry, at stake is the well-being and effectiveness of over 11,000 congregations, and in many cases their day schools as well, of at least 30 colleges of the church. If I hedge a little, it's because there are Canadian and American segments in the LCA, and some of this hinges on how the Canadian merger goes. But at least 30 colleges of the church, at least 8 theological seminaries in the United States, more than 200 nursing homes and other kinds of institutions of mercy, and some 30 agencies of social service, most of which are by now in partnership only among the 3 uniting churches, and therefore will be agencies of a single church beyond the development of that. And then beyond that, there is at stake the partnership of these 3 uniting churches in a number of interchurch organizations, principally the Lutheran Council in the USA, the Lutheran World Federation and its USA office called Lutheran World Ministries, the World Council of Churches, and for the LCA, the question of whether and what kind of relationship the new church will have to the National Council of Churches. All of that partnership question or ecumenical question is for tomorrow. I simply identify for you that when a church body starts to develop its organizational style, all the well-being and effectiveness of all those pieces of the church are at stake. And beyond that, of course, is the bigger question of the clear witness to and the clear witness through 5.5 million members. Today I thought it might be useful just to play a 6-minute segment from the tape that comes from the 1982 General Conventions of the 3 Uniting Churches. To give you some background for what I'm about to play, the vote totals have just been announced by the transcontinental telephone hookup of the 3 General Conventions, and there has just been applause at the fact that it, rather than just skinning through, the 3 conventions had very, very strongly, AELC unanimously, endorsed the proposals of the Committee for Lutheran Unity and therefore had just committed themselves to join in forming a new Lutheran church. Martin Marty then was asked, as church historian and preeminent Lutheran with such excellent instincts for what the church is about, Martin Marty was asked to make some comments. I'll play just that segment.
I don't know what Martin Luther would think if he heard the three bodies moving together in his spirit of the gospel were having a competitive contest to see who are the best enthusiasts. I've been given the awesome privilege and responsibility to spend just a couple of moments as an historian trying to put this day somehow into perspective. Abraham Lincoln once said, if we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we might know what to do and how to do it. The church also lives by this, and we find out where we are partly by an awareness of where we have been. Lutheran Christians have been on this continent for a third of a millennium, one-sixth of the Christian era, and that's many days. I do not know whether this day is the most dramatic event in that third of a millennium, but I do know that it stands the possibility of being the most decisive day for Lutheran life together to this point, and we hope it will be but a prefiguring of what will be coming. Perspective reminds us to say that we are not today bringing in the kingdom of God. We are not today fulfilling the Una Sancta. We are not overcoming all of the brokenness even in the churches of the Augsburg Confession. But anyone who studies, as many of us have in recent months, the compilations and the histories and the documents on Lutheran unity know that most pages have been frustrating pages and disappointing pages. And I think the enthusiasm today results from the fact that we are now starting volume two with a very promising page. Had we been able any time during these past 300 and more years to interview a typical immigrant, and our church came largely from other places, most of them would have joined their descendants who came from this place and their converts in giving not only lip service, but heartfelt sentiment to their regret over the fact that we did not know each other, that we were divided, often hostile, competitive. And those foreparents would have given voice to a dream which we believe would have been genuinely voiced. They wanted Lutherans to be united, to accept each other, to cooperate. Today we are given the privilege of beginning to realize the promise they dreamed of, to fulfill the mandates that began to move them. American religion has seen numbers of births of new churches out of old ones, and as an historian looking over the past, I find nothing really comparable to this venture in scope except perhaps in 1939, the reunion of Northern and Southern Methodist churches who had been divided so many years before by the North and South struggles. Lutherans had different issues. We came on different boats with different stories and different histories, different memories and hopes and languages and regions. Inevitably, we magnified those differences. I don't think today we stand in judgment on our foreparents who failed to bring us to this point. We thank them for their faithfulness by their life in their days. But we are very grateful to those who, through at least the past two generations, have worked to bring this day upon us. Only one out of 40 Americans is directly involved in today's activity, 5.5 million out of, say, 220 million people. All of us are aware that this is a sizable body that is taking shape, but that's not the main feature for us as we put this into perspective. Indeed, there's a little irony that we might be moved toward bigness in a day when our church people want immediacy and responsiveness. There would be an irony if we moved to mere homogeneity in a day when we are trying to give expression to cultural and ethnic and gendered diversity. There's only one reason we believe we have been moving toward where we are. It is intrinsic in the character of the gospel and the character of the church. It has its own value for any body of Christians to replace the inherited hatred or suspicion with love and trust. To move from a day when we did undercut, and maybe still on campus, in suburbs, could it be even in inner city, sometimes compete or fail to affirm. It is quite a move from the days when whatever unity we had was hidden or confusing to a day when we are free to manifest and realize it. We are ending this day, 300 years of a pattern of interim non-sharing of Eucharist and non-sharing of other forms of ministry. Who cares about what we do? Our lay people will not care in detail about everything that the committees and commissions will have to do. And there's no reason that they need to care about everything. But if their hearts join their lips in caring for the whole church and its mission, they will care about what they and their leadership can experience in the creative jostling that we expect in these years ahead. Part of this is another activity in our own convention, that as we open up to each other, we are quite likely to be opening more toward interim shared Eucharist with another Christian body. One of the presidents reminded us that all these moves are made also with pain and regret. We are finite and human, unfinished. Our work within our Lutheran family is by no means fully satisfying to us. But we look ahead, hoping that the catalysis, the interaction that will come as we come to know each other better, will help us move from what I used to call creative foot-dragging to creative pace-setting. Today we're celebrating the oneness of this part of the church as it moves toward the whole church. We celebrate its Catholicity. May we also come to know more of its holiness and its apostolicity in the great mission that we will be realizing more closely. With that in mind, in our three conventions, picturing having a single voice, we will move now to sing a hymn of the church's one foundation.
Well, I'm not sure how many of you heard that originally, but I thought it was worth playing just to hear again. The question I hope we can talk about now is, how should the new church organize itself to be maximally effective? Or, to use more dramatic language, how shall the new church search for servant structures? Some things seem fairly certain at the beginning, and I've talked a bit about some of them in earlier sessions this week. For example, we've said that the basic criterion for membership and ministry in the new church will be baptism. I say that the new church has to make the decision, but at least the Commission for New Lutheran Church is very clear about that. It will propose that our membership with each other is on the basis of our being baptized believers. Baptism is the base. We've also already heard the Commission say pretty clearly that the usual structure in which baptized believers will gather and through which they will serve will be the local congregation. There is no move afoot to minimize or in any way undermine the strength of local congregations. Quite the contrary, the argument is that if we do the new church right, that is to say, if we think through the right set of decisions in the right order, congregations might be even more fully served in order to more fully serve. And then another piece that we talked about yesterday, it is quite clear that the new church will take the word pastoral ministry rather broadly to describe what happens in parish settings, i.e. parish pastors, what happens in a variety of specialized settings, chaplains and teachers and others who are called to be pastors but in very different sorts of settings, and that we will define the office of bishop in pastoral terms. I'll come back to that last piece again later in the hour. It is also clear that we will be providing certain other forms of specific ministry, and here I go back to something that I promised somebody we would cover because we didn't get around to it yesterday. What are some of the other specific ministries that the new church is likely to endorse? Clearly, the commission sees that there are other leadership tasks in the church in addition to those that are performed by ordained clergy, and that that the new church needs to find a way not only to permit these, but in fact to undergird and support them. It would appear from the documents that are being proposed at this point that the Commission believes the new church ought to be quite pragmatic about this, that we don't have to go back and find every leadership function in the New Testament in order to have it in the current church, but that instead what matters is that we decide what the church needs to be doing in order to be doing the gospel, and then design whatever leadership roles we need. To quote the Task Force on Theology at that point, we need the freedom to develop particular forms of ministry that prove helpful in carrying out the mission of the church. Now, what that's likely to mean, the Task Force on Theology lifts out a few of them, and I thought it wouldn't hurt to just lift them out for you. They say, for example, two forms of ministry present to our church's particular concern or particular interest, the diaconate and the parish school teacher. And then it goes on to describe historically what deacons and deaconesses have been in Lutheran circles, and then goes on to suggest that we ought to find ways to ensure that the diaconal function, that is to say the serving function, is given proper leadership, whether we call the people who do that deacons and deaconesses or some other term, but that the function is important. And then the affirmation of parish parochial schools by way of affirming the role of parish teachers. Then some criteria that I thought you'd be interested in. Or first of all, another list. Among the other forms of ministry are evangelists, catechists, cantor or church musician, and college religion teacher. And then this language. To qualify as a form of specific ministry in the church, we propose a number of criteria. One has to do with training. Now I'm summarizing. One has to do with being properly called and set apart for it. One has to do with being held accountable for performing the responsibility assigned, and therefore these ministries ought to be under supervision, and so forth. Suggests that we ought to not confuse the issue by ordaining these various kinds of specific ministries, but that instead we ought to use commissioning or consecrating language in order that the church may also set apart these other forms. So that is in the mix. I've forgotten who asked me the question, but it would not be improper if you wanted to press it right now. Or does that give you what you need? All right. Now, I think the only fireworks that are likely to develop will be over the question of whether we ought to have an order of deacons. That's by no means clear yet. The only church body that has it is the Eastern Synod, or East Coast Synod, of the AELC. But there are a number of unofficial, that is to say, unofficially recognized, diaconal groups in several parts of the country, including a group here in the Pacific Northwest, one that centers in Baltimore and that area, one in Michigan, one that has some campus ministry loci in several parts of the country. I think that's a decision that will get deferred until the new church is well underway. But in the meantime, it is clear that the new church is going to undergird the idea of diaconal service much more than the existing churches do. Well, maybe that's enough to get at that set of issues. Yes?
Deacon, is that any thought to a deacon as outlined by the Episcopal Church?
The expanded diaconate, I'm using language that only some of the groups in this country use, but it's a way of trying to say they are not part of the traditional lifetime deacon and deaconess organizations, but are in fact people who are training and being set apart for ministries while being engaged in other vocations at the same time. If we could find the parallel language, they're worker priests. They are to deacon diaconal service what worker priests are to ordained service, that sort of thing. There is in those movements an interest in moving toward some one of the historic models. I think it's fair to say the big debate is really going to be whether they are to be liturgical deacons, which is what's showing up in Roman Catholic and Episcopal service circles, or whether they are to be serving deacons in the sense of Stephen and the other six in the book of Acts.
That would be a very neat kind of distinction to make, except that Stephen is martyred for preaching, not for serving the Hellenists at table. So in fact, the office was broader than its original subscription. It's just too soon to know whether the new church is going to recover a New Testament diaconal office, and if so, how it's going to distinguish it from the pastoral office.
Will the deacons just continue as is successful?
Now, you're talking about the traditional deaconess groups? Yes, the LCA has an official deaconess organization with not terribly large numbers, but at least a good solid functioning operation. The American Lutheran Church, in its 1960 merger, dissociated itself from formal connections that antecedent churches had had with several organizations, the one in Milwaukee, the one in Brooklyn, the one in Chicago, which was already then in the process of closing, the one in Brush, Colorado. Those are the ones I think of right offhand. The only one of those that had any official relationship beyond the 1960 merger was the Deaconess Motherhouse in Milwaukee, and it had connection only by virtue of becoming a congregation of the Southern Wisconsin District of the ALC, and has since disbanded that. So I can't answer that. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has always had a more viable operation because it has always been more willing to leave the celibacy question as an option, where the other diaconal movements were pretty locked in, except the small Danish one centered in Brush, Colorado. And the others were always for women only, except, again, for the one in Brush, Colorado, which was both male and female. What makes this so complicated is that the diaconal movements, or the deaconess movements, were partly the only available remedy for the fact that the churches would not allow women to become pastors. And now that the churches welcome women as pastors, it's questionable whether the deaconess movement has sufficient attractiveness in its own right to continue to operate. The evidence would seem to say no at this point. Okay, a quick look, and I mean quick, at what scripture and history have to say about the organization of the church. I'll just tick these off, and then if you want elaboration, say so. It is clear that organization was a very low priority in the earliest church. And that it was for two reasons. The first was, so many of those in the earliest church had direct personal experience with Jesus and didn't have to depend on some kind of mediating structure. And secondly, they had a lively expectation of the prompt return of Jesus, so why bother to organize? As the apostles died off or were murdered, as less and less members of the church had that immediate action, structural or organizational questions start to become important. There's already some structure, of course, during Jesus' ministry, namely the selection of the 12, and on another occasion, the commissioning and sending out of the 70. And while it's not as clearly evident, there was a camp following that was larger than the 12 and that included a number of women who traveled with and became interpreters of and supporters of what Jesus was doing. It is also clear that Paul was, as Acts 9:15 puts it, a chosen instrument of mine, that's God speaking, to establish the church. So there's the structure of missionary activity right away. There was also the selection of the 7 deacons, as I just mentioned, but while they were called to supervise the feeding of those who had been disowned by their own families because they had become Christian, and who therefore were likely to starve or suffer greatly unless somebody cared for them, it is also clear that the deacons were chosen not just for their ability to serve at table, but that also at least one of them, Stephen, was very quickly a very articulate evangelist with a very solid sense of the history of the gospel. There is at least one reference to a deaconess in Romans 16:1 to Phoebe. There are a number of references to house churches and to their leaders, and it is clear that they were led by both men and women, and that the references are pretty equal in their treatment. There was the commissioning and supporting of missionaries to start new churches, as reflected in Acts 13 when Paul and Barnabas are set apart, and that the churches, it just happened, it's a sideline reference in that Acts 13 passage, that these churches already had prophets and teachers. And you hear those as two entries out of the longer list that show up in Corinthians and Ephesians and other places, of the offices or the leadership persons, kinds of persons, that local churches already had. There was also, if you want to talk organizational terms, there was also the beginning of an organization for coordinating disaster relief, namely the gathering of funds for the relief of the saints in Jerusalem when their goods and their food ran out. There was also a policy decision about how to deal with controversy. You see that in Acts 15, when it became clear that there were two dominant ways of dealing with the question of the Gentiles. There was Peter's way, and apparently he had a lot of support from other Hebrew Christians, Peter's way of saying, once you have become convinced to be a Christian and been baptized, you also ought to take on the obligations of the Jewish law, particularly the kosher requirements and things like that. And there was Paul's way that said, no, the gospel is more radical than that. There is neither Jew nor Greek. And the council at Jerusalem, recorded in Acts 15, is a general council of the church, a gathering of the church to decide a question. They didn't vote on it precisely. You are probably aware of that. They used a different method. They used the method of having commentators from time to time summarize. And if the summary didn't sound good, the debate started over again. But if nobody raised any big hassle over the summary, then the biblical phrase is, and it seemed good to them that. And in this case, it was James who summarizes in Acts 15, and the rest decided that was a pretty good compromise. Gentiles didn't have to become Jews, but out of deference for the Jews, they would not eat meat that had been strangled but not bled, and so forth. And they would not eat things that had been sacrificed to idols. And then you know that there are those longer lists of the gifts to the church, and his gifts were that some should be apostles, some prophets, some teachers, and so forth. And it was in the wisdom of God that the lists we have don't agree with each other. And that's very helpful, because it says to us, there's not a set list that you have to replicate, but instead there's an illustrative list. Now you decide what you need in order to get your mission done in your day. That's a quick look at the biblical materials. Do you want to react or respond or add to it at all? I wouldn't hurry, except I want to get to the heart meat of what the new church has to grapple with. Any questions or comments you want to add at that point? All right. Now, what will the new? Let me start looking at questions, and I'm going to go from the local to the national and back to whatever's in between. That'll be the sequence of the rest of our time. What will the new church structure for congregations? I suggested yesterday, probably there will be no basic change in the scope of the authority or the mission of the local congregation. Let me read a segment from the Purpose Task Force, what it is proposing for the constitution of the new church. It says that the constitution should, this is not yet constitutional language, it's language to those who will draft it. It says the constitution should affirm the vital nature of the life and ministry of congregations, including the normal responsibility of each congregation to make decisions regarding the conduct of ministry in its community, the calling of its pastor or pastors, and the ownership of its property. I suspect we would not have said that much about it in the purpose statement, except that those who are opposed to the uniting of these three churches have deliberately chosen to ignore that kind of understanding and have been spreading the rumor that the new church is going to take away the local polity or the local responsibility and authority of the congregation over its own affairs. And so we are going out of our way. Documents have a way of going out of their way to answer issues, especially issues that are raised in bad faith. And this one is being raised in bad faith by those who stand on the extreme conservative side of our churches or even outside of them. The president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has invited those congregations that think they're going to lose their freedom in the new church to consider joining Missouri. The former president, Jack Freund, not the current one. He used the occasion of visiting our convention to invite those of our churches who felt that they were no longer comfortable to join Missouri. It took a lot of gall, but it was said that way. So congregations are not likely to experience any significant difference in their local authority. They are likely to experience some difference in how they receive resources. That is to say, the new church will gradually develop ways to deliver both curriculum, there's not likely to be a dramatic change there, and leadership resources. I'll come back to that when we talk about the in-between structures. And there's likely, again looking at the local congregation, to be a new model constitution. In fact, our ALC is already working on one for itself. That is not, I say this with a board member of Life and Mission sitting here, which is not likely to see the day until the new church is already in operation. And then I think the new church will do one. But at any rate, model constitution is always kind of in flux and ought to be. There will be some way to secure clergy and to assure that clergy are being properly supervised, and that has to do with our discussion of bishops. And there will be, as there is now, opportunity for congregations to participate in mission that is beyond their own locality and for which their own resources would not alone be sufficient. Now let me go to first of all, let's just see if you want to ask questions about congregational concerns. I've just said, in effect, that congregational life in the locality is not likely to be much affected. That is true for all of those congregations except those who are in relatively isolated settings. The more isolated congregations are likely, rather quickly, to experience the richness of having a lot more close neighbors of the same church body. That will more often be blessing than problem. There will be a few times when they are too close to each other, but on the other hand, they're too close to each other already then. But there will be congregations in isolated settings that will welcome the expansion of their fellowship options. But for most of our congregations, their local life will not be much changed. Let's see if you have questions or comments at that point.
What I'm curious about, Roger, is the call procedure for pastors. Now, you know, like in the North Pacific District, it's much different than it is in South Dakota.
Yeah.
The bishop comes and he gives one person to that congregation. Now, I have relatives back in the South Dakota District who are very unhappy with that because they said it takes away our options. You know, they remember the days when they used to have their own call committee, and they'd run around and they'd do all that, and, you know, and so they're very unhappy with what's happening in South Dakota. And I want to know, is that going to become a procedure for the whole church, or is that going to go by the wayside if the congregation says, hey, I don't want that?
That would be a function of the bishop rather than the church itself, though.
Well,
there's a different call procedure in different districts, but the bishop would be the one that would be controlling that.
The question, yeah, both of your questions are apropos. Let me try to respond. First of all, for those who don't know it, our South Dakota district and now two other districts have a call procedure that vests more authority in a district-wide call committee, with the congregation ending up with the option only of saying yes or no to a given candidate, and then if they say no, they can get another candidate offered to them. There are a couple of LCA synods that use a similar offering of only one name at a time, but not with a district call committee behind it. So it is not unique to one church body or the other, but it is the minority style in all three of the churches. I don't think AELC has that limitation anywhere. Your question, first of all, is that likely to be the style of the new church? Certainly not a required style. It's not required now. It's an option that's allowed within the ALC pattern. I happen to be quite positive about it, and I was at one point asked to do a survey in South Dakota and did it and became positive about it on the basis of the survey, because you, at least 8 to 10 years ago, your sources would have been in a minority. Most of the people I interviewed liked it and said they wanted it to continue. On the other hand,
it works only where it is strongly embraced, and it may not work everywhere. It is not the model that's going to be promoted. That's the immediate answer to your question. The other question is, will the new church have a uniform, and that's what you're raising, will the new church have a uniform set of call procedures? Maybe, maybe not. I think it is more likely to have what we now have, and that is some general guidelines. And then each bishop or each district, or whatever we call the judicatory in the new church, will adapt those guidelines to its own needs. And guidelines in our kind of usage, in the usage of the three uniting churches, guidelines usually mean putting a fence around the limit, but allowing flexibility in between. My guess is we'll end up with guidelines, and that we won't have them until well after the new church is organized. And in the meantime, it'll be local options, local meaning districts or judicatory. But I'm guessing, because the commission has not come to that question yet. Enough? Okay. More?
Question. There's been a lot of problems in Missouri as to congregations that some wanted to go to AELC, some wanting to stay. Who gets the property? Is this spoken to?
It will be.
It will.
But it's likely to be spoken to in the model constitution for congregations rather than in the national one. And model constitutions don't have to be adopted by local congregations, as you well know. We have congregations in the ALC who are still operating off a model that predates the 1930 merger and has only been translated, but it's still the same constitution. So I don't think there's any classic answer to that. The LCA is unfairly accused of having a structure that allows the LCA to take over the property of local congregations. Technically, their General Secretary Reuben Swanson said, technically that's true under certain circumstances, particularly involving division in the congregation. Practically, he has not seen it done, nor the General Secretary of the LCA has not seen it done on any occasion where a congregation properly made a decision. The property has gone with. And I know from having worked with our disciplinary process that in the American Lutheran Church, the six congregations that have been disciplinarily removed from our roster over the last 22 years have all taken their property with them. That has never been a question. So I think it's one of those false issues that are raised by people who are either so imbued with congregational autonomy or who are simply trying to create disruption for us. But the issue has not yet been addressed by the new church.
I think the group that is causing a lot of tendency on the part of congregations that are in good standing now to cause them to doubt whether or not they're going to be able to retain their property. And I think that somewhere in some publication, a Lutheran Standard somewhere, a statement should be made from our orders.
Well, we have, if I can jump in. I addressed that for the American Lutheran Church in Acts, in the issue that's just now coming out. Well, this came out in July. Have some of you seen it? That went out to about 70,000 of our parish leaders and all of our parish clergy. The commission itself has developed a four-page response to that and has publicized that in its progress report. And the LCA is distributing a similar statement to people who ask. We have responded to it, and we've responded in documentary terms, not just in terms of opinion. But it's hard to get people to read. Acts is not going to win Pulitzer Prize, and it doesn't always get read from cover to cover. You're right, of course. We have to keep answering the question. Charging on. Let me talk now about the other end of the scale, the national structure. In terms of the mood of the land these days, decentralization is currently kind of an in thing. Try to reduce the social service functions of the federal government and let the states make up their own minds. And try to decentralize decision-making, decentralize the gathering and the spending of tax monies and so forth.
In spite of that, when the preference poll was done at the Synod and District Conventions of our United Churches in the spring of 1981, out of four options that were offered, running from do nothing to strongly centralized new church, the people who summarized that said, it would appear that the people of these three churches want option three and a half. What that means is they wanted option four, which was strongly centralized national church, but they wanted more regional structure in addition than our present strong centralization provides. So they seemed to want option three and a half. Strong central, also strong region. If that's accurate, and if the commission then feels similarly guided in its suggestion, the chances are that these are the things that will show up in the national structure of the new church. Now, you hear me hedging, because I'm ahead of the commission, and the commission may see it quite differently, but this is what it looks like to me at this point. We are likely to see that in terms of inter-church, interdenominational relationships, both in this country and with other churches around the world, that is likely to be lodged with the national church. It is likely to be one new Lutheran church making decisions about its relationship with other churches, not seven regions or 90 districts or whatever. Secondly, it is likely that the new church will give itself permission to develop a strong, clear, national voice on national and international issues. After all three of our churches have through the 60s and early 70s, come through that time of self-doubt about whether the church had any right to an opinion. We have all come to terms with the fact that the separation of church and state, as articulated by the Constitution and by the Southern Baptists in this country, does not mean that we have to be silent on issues of national policy. It rather means that we are to be institutionally separate, church, religious institutions, and governmental ones, but that we have a right to both have an opinion and to express it forcefully, as long as we are not attempting to use the government for the well-being of the institutional church. So the church is likely to try to find a way to develop statements and activities on controverted social issues and service issues in the life of the nation and in the world. Third piece, we are likely
to leave that
yes.
The point, just who this body is going to make up the mind of the church that establishes all of these
yeah.
political tones that kind of bother me at times. Because the church is the body of all who are involved. And yet, many times it seems to me that becomes a clerical
yeah.
Problem, one that I think we have to be watchful for.
First of all, I didn't use the word political. You did. I don't object. I don't object to your using it, but I want to make clear that I didn't.
Okay.
Because I think the case can be built that the church should not normally be involved in political process, but it ought to be involved in legislative process, or it ought to be involved in the development of public opinion. And since that is in fact a political process, I don't object to your using it. I don't know if you've been aware. I try not, for example, to personalize the government. I do not talk about the policies of the Reagan administration. I talk about the policies of the federal government, because I think we ought to distinguish those. The church addresses the issues of the policies of the federal government, and it's likely to do that nationally, and it's likely to do that through a representative assembly. The churches may address state issues, and they'll have to find a state structure or a state assembly through which to do that.
Local congregations have to decide how to address local issues and do that. Now, you raised the question of the danger, you said, of clericalism. There is the other danger, and that's that representatives will speak without having been authorized and therefore without really representing. Both of those are issues, I think. The new church will have to find a way to make sure that nobody speaks as representative unless he or she has been given that representation
responsibility. How you combat exceptionally clerical opinion, I don't know. You may want to test your thesis as you go along. It has become increasingly the case that the social issues that are most prominently pressed in the church body I'm a part of are initially being raised in student circles or being raised in district conventions, and very often by lay people with a strong head of steam for a particular kind of issue. In fact, the history of American social issues would suggest that clericalism hasn't always been the case. What has more typically been the case is that it's been clergy who have been spokespersons for, but not necessarily the originators of. But having said that, I want to grant you that our church tends to grant a lot of license to clergy, and that we will have to find ways to make sure that it is not a clergy-dominated church in its social concerns.
Well, how about describing the assembly that you were referring to in that level?
It's too early to know yet whether this, first of all, it is not yet clear that the national church will have a national headquarters. The Roman Catholic model is not ruled out yet. The Roman Catholic model in this century is that there is a conference, the United States Catholic Bishops Conference, with an agency office in Washington, D.C., and certain functions that are carried on there. And then the bishops meet at least annually, all 200 and however many there are of them, and legislate within the bounds that are allowed. I tend to think that would not work for us on two counts. First is, they work within the parameters set by a worldwide church, namely by the Vatican. And secondly, I don't think our church is about to turn over to bishops for decision making. We have moved steadily toward greater lay participation. We have a number of districts in the ALC now where parish clergy do not even automatically have the vote at district convention. I look for that to be the direction of our new church rather than the direction toward clericalism. But how big a national assembly and how chosen, that's just too early to say yet. What is clear is that we've gotten used to national conventions as being very decisive. I can't imagine us backing away from that. More? I'm still running a list of what is most likely to be in the national structure. But I have question marks next to the next two. Well, let me add another certain one. It is almost certain that we will have a national pension and benefit scheme or schemes, because it is simply easier to administer those and to get them recognized by the government and so forth. Now I've got question marks next to the following two. It is probable that the support for and the supervision of theological education will be a national function in the new church. I hedge on two counts. The one is it's not decided yet. The other is it is not the dominant style of the LCA. But in those places where we have merged seminaries in the Twin Cities and in Columbus, Ohio, the move has been toward greater national funding and national supervision, even by the LCA. And on that basis, it appears to me that the trend is in that direction, that we are likely to make national decisions about how many seminaries, where they are, what we expect from them, and how we fund them. We are likely, but you hear the question mark after that one. I think that's the better way to do it, but time will tell. The second iffy one here is the question of the World Mission Enterprise. I can't resist a divisive statement at this point. I think that it has become fashionable to take pot shots at the missionary enterprise by people who see a different kind of picture. But I have to say that for those of us who see what the World Mission Enterprises of our churches are doing and the way they are linking, there's a great deal of vitality. And I think we will have a national mission program in the new church that, despite its detractors, will continue to do a very powerful kind of witness. And I take exception to some of the pot shots that are taken. But whether that will be a national program nationally supported, or whether there will be some decentralization of both the support and descending, it's a little soon to know. It depends on how strong the regions are in the new church. So I hedge on that one as to whether it will be fully national or partly regional as well. Now, that's one list. A second list is things about which there's just no clarity at all yet. Let me try that list for you. There's no certainty at all yet about whether the new church will have a national, what we used to call home mission program, congregational development, the subsidization of congregations in transition, that sort of thing. Right now, the money and the energy seems to flow towards area raised and area spent money. And the national budgets of all three of the United Churches have been suffering in recent years. And yet when they do special appeals that are particularly for home mission development, the appeals are very well received, suggesting that there is a lot of energy for the direct transmission of money from the pockets of believers to the starting of missions, and relatively less appeal to national budgets and unified distribution of funds. Whether that's a temporary trend or a permanent one, it's hard to say, because precisely the opposite trend came in the years after World War II, with marked advance in home missions, because the national churches saw what was needed and were able to take hold of it and in a visionary way lay out an option. Well, I don't know, but how we'll fund and administer home mission work, I don't know. What is clear is that we will continue to need a method of raising funds where there are lots of Lutheran funds available and transferring it to areas where there is great mission need. And if we don't do that, we run the risk of becoming, in a sense, incestuous, continuing to invest where we're already strong and not knowing how to invest where we most need to be anxious. Same kind of issue is raised with regard to social service agencies and institutions. There is just no clarity at all yet about whether they ought to be nationally supported or regionally supported or supported by judicatories or supported by their own boards. Hard to say, and it's just not addressed yet. Question of campus ministry support. At a time when it looked very promising that campus ministry work was going to be done in league with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, then it was clear it ought to be an outside agency with everybody contributing to it and decisions made there. Now Missouri is backing off of one statewide campus ministry agency after another, and if in fact the campus ministry, Lutheran campus ministry work is going to be done by our church alone, then we probably ought to find a way to do it within our structure, not through an agency. And then should it be through the national structure, or region, or judicatory? I'm using the word judicatory to get away from saying synod / district. I don't know which is the better way to do it, but I'll try it that way. So that's a kind of question. And the other question that just continues to plague us, and that we really have to address carefully, is the one Marty talked about. Is bigger better? Certainly we don't want to become an impersonal church. The two big churches are already too big to be personal. We already crossed that line 20 years ago. So the question is, how do we avoid impersonality and regimentation and still be a strong church? The national church is going to want to limit itself in the kind of functions it does so that it doesn't try to run things that it would have to run impersonally. It's going to have to find ways to engage in genuine participatory decision making, and it is just not at all clear how to pull that off yet. That's one of the big questions the commission grapples with. Give you a chance to talk about that, and then I want to do a few minutes on the intermediate stuff. I don't know. It'd be fun to come back and do it in 2 years on the basis of what the 84 convention approved and what the commission has been doing in 85, because that will be the next time of great uncertainty. That's a possibility. Besides, like, you can come back to hold it. Well, let me talk about intermediate structures for a minute. Clearly, we will need them. District, as we know it in the ALC, or Synod as you know it in the LCA, and Synod as you have come to know it in ACLC, these are structures that evolve. They were never created by national decisions on the frontier. They evolved out of the need for some kind of, I don't like the biblical word, but it's the only one that's there, of oversight. The problem is in the English language, not the Greek. In English, to have an oversight means to neglect something. But, and that's not what the biblical word means. To oversee means to supervise, and I think we ought to use the word supervise instead. But supervisory structures evolved in our churches, evolved out of congregational needs for clergy, and in some way to get them trained or attracted from the old world or whatever it took. Supervision grew out of the fact that sometimes congregations got into internal squabbles, or congregations and their pastors got into squabbles, or sometimes great controversies developed, and somebody needed to at least preside over those hassles, if not resolve them. So we have the evolution of structure. We clearly are at a stage in the life of our church where even the small church, the ACLC, felt it needed that regional structure and had for a while five synods and still has four of them, two of them merged. We'll have to have something at the judicatory level. It would appear, and if there's time, I think there is, I'm going to read quickly to you. It would appear that for the first time, we're going to be clearer about what a bishop might do, and in the process, we are really saying what a judicatory would do. Let me run down a list of nine, just picking them off. That a bishop would, in the new church, see the God-given mandate to be a pastor, preach the gospel rightly, to administer the sacrament in accordance with their institution. The mandate of a bishop is to see to it that this gospel is rightly preached and the sacraments are rightly administered in the churches of the region in which they serve. I don't think that's new, but in some ways it's clearer. Second, the bishop leads the church in the mission outreach of the gospel to the unchurched in the region, whole mission work. Third, the bishop has the responsibility to foster the unity of the church by visitation, by facilitating interchange, cooperation, communication, the material and spiritual assistance among the parishes of the region. The role of fostering unity of the wider church by communication, cooperation with other bishops and regions of the church. I'm not sure that one will make it through the convention. That starts to move toward an Episcopal and Catholic understanding of bishops. I'll be surprised if that one makes it. Fourth, the bishop shall lead the church to study the problems of contemporary life and society in order that the church might contribute to solving those problems. That's what I sometimes call the teaching function of the bishop. We have clearly, steadily been moving in that direction by the kinds of people we've been elected, but we have in the meantime not changed their job description. They have an administrative job description, but we've been calling people who are by instinct and training teachers. Fifth, the bishop shall lead the church in the pursuit of its ecumenical task. I don't think that one will survive. Sixth, the bishop should have the responsibility to assist and advise congregations in fulfilling the specific ministries in local communities when they become vacant, in other words, the call process. Seventh, the bishop has the responsibility to sponsor and oversee candidates for ordination, to participate in their examinations, and to authorize and or preside at their ordination. If that one survives, what it means is taking the present LCA Church Vocation Committee pattern and using it in the new church. My guess is it'll survive. That there's been enough dissatisfaction in the ALC with the lack of district involvement in the recruiting and relating to people during their seminary careers to make me think this is the direction we're likely to go. Eighth, the bishop leads pastors in the discussion of theological problems and in the identification of modern heresies which threaten the integrity of the gospel. I like that phrase. And ninth, in their lives, bishops should not be domineering taskmasters, but exemplary shepherds, and they quote from 1 Peter and 1 Timothy. That's a quick list. Listening to that, I think you also hear primarily what districts are likely to be around, about districts or judicatories or synods, whatever we want to call those synods. Even the word diocese is being considered. And it won't surprise me that that's where we'll end up, because diocese allows us to use common language with the Episcopalians with the Roman Catholic, and in some parts of the world with the Reformed tradition. Time will tell.
Yes.
No, I'm not. I'm about to talk about reason. Yeah, Joel.
Just a quick question. Why do you think the ecumenical role will not survive? Do you think that's relegated to an
aspect? Not relegated.
Of the world.
No. I think the churches will decide that we should have one national voice on ecumenical matters, not 90 regional, not 90 Jesus or whatever. Okay, regions. Do we or do we not need regional structures in this church? Do we need a fourth level? Now, it's fair to say the ALC has conferences, the LCA has a, that's a kind of a 15, 20, 30 congregation cluster in the geographic area of a radius of anywhere from 10 to 100 miles, depending on what part of the country you're in. We have one conference for all of Oklahoma, but we have two for the Twin Cities, you know, that kind of stuff. LCA calls them districts, but they are the same size and with relatively the same function. And the AELC has, now what do you call your regional district? I guess you just call them regional districts. And you do some clustering wherever possible. Do we? And those have not been particularly effective in any of the three churches. So nobody has any great head of steam for preserving that particular form. But there, one can go in two directions. You can either go toward clusters that are much more local, a half dozen congregations in a radius of 10 miles, and try it that way. There is some limited success with clusters. Or you can go the other direction and say what we need is smaller districts on the order of 100 or 150 congregations, radius. If we did that with our 11,000, that would mean 100 bishops, or let's say 80 or 90 bishops. Typical districts in most of the areas of the country would then have a radius of not more than 100 miles. Think of the town meeting office. Think of the ease with which that kind of judicatory could meet regularly, could think together, could study together, things that are just not possible now. If that happens, though, can you jump directly from 90 of those to a national church? Or is that too big a jump? And should there instead be regions? And if so, how many and for what purpose? If regions are proposed for the new church, it is likely that there'll be 6 to 7 or 8 of them proposed. A northeast, a mid-Atlantic, a southeast, an Ohio River Valley, an upper Midwest, a southwest, meaning Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, New Mexico, Colorado, that sort of group, a one or two on the Pacific West Coast. Hard to say, but regions, at least thinking about them in those big globs, this Nine Nations book that some of you are aware of, seven of the nine in there would work for us too. Those are economic and demographic unities. The western ones of those don't work for us. You can't put San Francisco and a 20-mile band up the coast and Alaska together and call them a region for us, which is the way that one does. That's a good economic region, but not a good churchly one. But something like that may happen. Is it fully the church? Does it have an archbishop? I doubt it. Does it have an administrator and primarily administrative role? Probably. Is it a creation of the national church or of the judicatory or both? Does it have a legislative body? Does it compete for funds rather than being funded by those who are raising funds? Those are the kinds of questions. And Dan, I don't have any answers for that. I can just say that's the sense of the question. One final note. Then the bell's about to ring. Or did it already? No. You heard the word flexibility bandied about. It will be easiest to be flexible about national structures. We have organized twice in the last 25 years and reorganized twice in the two big churches. And AELC has organized from scratch once. So we have a body of 5 separate experiences in how to put together a national structure. All of them readily available to our memory, and the pitfalls and the problems terribly obvious. It is likely that we can put together a national structure that can be restructured every 10 years or so, and it's likely that that's needed. The hardest place to be flexible is at the judicatory level. And that's the one where we have to be the most careful. So we are likely to make decisions, first of all, about how to undergird congregations, then how to understand judicatories and the work of a bishop, and then decide about regions, and then instructions.